You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, May 16th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Cliff Schechter headed to his reunion. So we've got the great Tina Dupuy, syndicated columnist, with us to recap what really has been A sleeper of a crazy week, I realize. Also on the program today, more out, Jill Abramson out, the executive editor of the New York Times. Was it because she found out she was getting paid less? Not only as executive editor, but her prior positions than men in that position. Also on the program, Michael Boggs' nomination. Stick a fork in him. Amazing. Two stories of an amazing amount of pushback and success in some respects. The Boggs and the story of net neutrality. That story's not over yet. But the success is measurable. Meanwhile, 150 cities around the globe see fast food workers strike. And speaking of strike, another marriage equality ban struck down, this time in Arkansas, of all places. An amazing, amazing week. Rush Limbaugh, of course, still suffering under... We will get to that story in the horrible story of this turkey mine disaster, which is still ongoing, and the privatization that led to it. And of course, we have a couple of clips from some of our favorite nut jobs around the web. We have one from Alex Jones, where he crashed a Moms Demand Action event. These are families who are fighting for some form of sensible gun reform. And Chief Kessler, he's back. And all you lily-livered libtards out there should watch out. I want to
even that you
show.
Would say lily-livered shows what a, frankly, a pussy you are.
All right.
According to Chief Kessler.
Right.
I mean, the language he uses is a lot more powerful. It's a lot more super male vitality, if I may.
Yes. We are still on the super male vitality kick from yesterday.
Not literally. But
not literally. Though maybe soon. We had quite a time in the better half of the program yesterday. All right. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tina Dupuy. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Syndicated columnist, friend of the show, Tina Duppy.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Tina. We tried to play the Danger Zone theme song for you, but sadly, it did not. It did not take. So, how are you, Tina?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, all right, we got a lot to talk about. Let's start with your story about Clinton, because I want to get to. There's been some pretty big successes this week. It's been a quiet week, but in some respects, I feel like we're starting to we're seeing some victories that really have nothing to do with electoral politics, but have to do with people sort of mobilizing. They're not necessarily. Well, let's start with Clinton, and we'll get into that other stuff, because there was a story at the beginning of the week, I guess it was, where Karl Rove was attempting to already set the table for 2016.
Right. Well, and let's remember that we're talking about Karl Rove, who quite famously started off his political career finding a bug in his office and calling a press conference and just asking the question that maybe his opponent must have planted it, because really, who else would have put that in his office? So he kind of has been doing these kind of stunts, floating things out there for a very long time. And he's been incredibly successful with it, obviously, two terms as Bush's brain. So there's been this kind of preemptive strike against Hillary Clinton. I would argue that Daryl Issa has been trying to do this as much as possible. The reason why the Republicans are now using Benghazi instead of commas is because they want to preemptively take out Clinton as a contender in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that they think they're going to be able to take her out as much as it is. I mean, what's fascinating to me about this is just it is a great example of how these guys both understand the right wing sort of bloodstream, mm-hmm. and just how far down the road they're looking. I mean, this is the stuff when we talk about Benghazi, nobody's going to be talking about this in the mainstream media. Nobody's going to be talking about Hillary Clinton's brain damage that she supposedly has in 2015. But I can almost guarantee this is going to be daily stuff on Sean Hannity's program. And if they still are paying Rush Limbaugh all that money on his program, this is the stuff that they're going to be making money off of their base. I mean, this, and we
right,
don't.
Because it's not going to change Hillary Clinton. People who are neutral on Hillary Clinton, they're not who's watching Sean Hannity every day.
Right.
And just to be clear.
So what we're watching, I think, on some level is just sort of, we need to provide, they do a high game and a low game, and we need to provide the sort of the fodder for the low game now, because most of those people, now, with that said, most of their same voters, I would imagine at this point, or at least a big chunk of them, if they're not dead anyways, still remember things like Travelgate and Vince Foster Gate and Whitewater Gate and all the other gates that they were pushing at that time. But I think this is an indication on their part that they realize they need more in their war chest. So let's say that she's got brain damage.
Right. Or let's ask the question. I mean, that's how you kind of start these things. You're like, well, I just want to ask the question. And that's how birtherism started, right? Well, I'm just asking the question. There's nothing. And it's like, well, when that question gets answered, they still ask the question. And that's how this stuff kind of like gets out into the ethos of Republican talking points, because once there you see the evidence, you go, well, I just think it's interesting.
Right.
And
exactly.
It never quite ends. And we saw that with birtherism a couple of these other like right wing conspiracies. That's what's been going on with the Benghazi. It's like we've had 13 public hearings about this incident. where there were 39 comparable incidents under the Bush administration, during the Bush administration, and we never saw that kind of scrutiny. So we are not getting more evidence. We're just having more hearings, and there's just we're repeatedly asking the same questions, even though we've been given the answers over and over again. It continues to kind of fester because questions continue to exist, even though they've been answered.
Right. And
it's rhetorically kind of fascinating, yet also like unscrupulous and a gross, actually.
Yeah. And you know, this is not I don't want people to take this the wrong way. This is not any statement on whether or not Hillary Clinton should be president. As much as it is just watching the way that they operate. It's fascinating to me. And I think it, it is. In some respects, it's becoming less and less relevant, particularly when we talk about presidential elections, because they don't have the ability to sort of get the media en masse on board in the way that they did. And, you know, what I thought was also interesting this week, and I do want to get to these other things, but that when you look at a guy like Marco Rubio, who went out there at the beginning of the week, maybe it was the end of last week, denying climate change, what has been fascinating to me is that he has taken so much grief about that comment in the mainstream media. I mean, this is not, you know, this is not really anything terribly surprising to come out of the mouths of a Republican presidential candidate, particularly over the past, you know, whatever it is, 6 years since 2008. It's not that surprising, but he is being sort of, I guess, marginalized by the mainstream media in a way that is extremely encouraging to me, at least for someone, you know, who you know, I don't want my kids to have to develop lung, you know, gills essentially, so that they can breathe in, you know, living in Brooklyn, let's say. But I just found it fascinating that.
Well, I think that what you're talking about is his timing was really rotten. So this report comes out that basically says, like, this is something that climate change is real. Climate change is something that we need to worry about. And it's a, you know, threat to national security, blah, blah, blah. That report comes out. And then you have someone who was kind of like, he had always been, said that, I think at some point he said that it existed, but it wasn't man-made kind of thing, like the climate changes. And then he just kind of took a turn to the right in a very, inopportune time.
Yeah.
Where instead of going, yes, I saw the data and this is what I think based on new information, he just kind of went the opposite direction. And then, not only started denying science when it came to climate change, but also said that there's a general consensus, with scientists that life begins at conception, which is just, scientists actually say that ever. So it like, he kind of like started denying science and then it was like this avalanche of science denying. And I think also that's what he's been getting grief for.
Yeah. Well, he's not a scientist, man. Although he's, he is in some ways smarter than a scientist.
Oh,
when it comes to science. All right. Now let's move on here. Cause there's a couple of stories that, we've been following this week that I think, you know, should touch on it. And it's very good news, I think, in some respects. The people hopefully by now know Michael Boggs was one of the nominees by President Obama to sit on the judiciary on the circuit court in Georgia, the federal circuit court, district court. He specifically is for the Northern District of Georgia, and this is a lifetime post, people should remember. He is part of a deal of, I think it was seven nominees, that four of them were basically Republican picks, three of them Democratic. This deal had to take place between the White House and two Republican Georgia senators so that they would give up their blue slips. It's essentially their own mini filibuster to get a hearing on these nominations. And there was tremendous amount of pushback in the weeks leading up to this this is sort of under the radar, I think, unless you're really following this stuff, from groups like NARAL, from LGBT groups, from actually, I think, you know, we started to see towards the end some more pushback from places like the CBC, because this guy also was very adamant that the Confederate flag fly over the dome in Georgia. And it now appears like his nomination is going to be is going to go down in flames.
Yes. And it should. I mean, the oppo on this guy was just astounding. I mean, there's a record of his voting, but I mean, he sat on the Judiciary Committee in the Georgia State House for 4 years, and what came out of that committee was actually really shocking pieces of legislation, and most of them didn't actually come up for a vote, there were symbolic bills that Republicans love, but there were things like, in order to get an abortion, you had to go in front of a jury and have that, you know, have that fetus sentenced to death in order to get an abortion. I mean, like, really kind of disgusting and over the top, and really something that, like, clearly showed that this committee was just not very serious about women's health. There were a couple of these bills that came out of this committee as he sat there like I said, there was no vote that ever came up, but then the stuff that he did vote for was pretty extreme.
It was putting the names of abortion providers,
you got it,
online, and sat in the committee hearing and told Al Franken that at the time he just wasn't aware that there was any violence perpetrated against abortion providers. And then in about 5 minutes, we dug up a story of a 1997 bombing that took place 3 years before the guy voted on this.
Right.
In Atlanta. Yes. In fact, it was two bombings. They did one bomb and timed the second one to go off an hour later, so that the media and the police who came for the first bomb got hit by the second bomb. I mean, the idea that he didn't know about that is just beyond the pale. So,
right.
You know.
So, yeah, exactly. Compiling a hit list, essentially, for extremists. You got it.
That's exactly what it is.
Yes. And then the bill he co-sponsored was the Choose Life license plate, which funds money directly into CPCs, and which are, you know, those fake clinics that trick women, you know, under the guise of getting a free pregnancy test, trick women into getting non-medical help when they are pregnant. So that was something that he co-sponsored. And remind you, this is a Democrat.
Right.
This is a Democrat.
Who's been nominated to the judiciary, and, you know, right. He claimed that since he's become a judge, a state judge, he sees things a little bit differently. And what's relevant there is that this is a guy who was also bemoaning activist judges who are supposedly reading into the Constitution that women have a right to choose, that gay people have a right to marry, that et cetera, et cetera. I mean, who knows what the other you know, sort of issues he felt that activist judges were pushing. And so this week, Harry Reid came out on Wednesday that he was not going to vote, or I should say on Thursday, he said, I'm going to oppose him. On Wednesday, he said, I'm pretty sure I'm going to oppose him, which was very atypical for Reid to come out ahead of a committee chair in that way. Leahy made it clear at the beginning of the hearing on, I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday, that no one on the Senate Judiciary Committee was beholden to the deal that the White House made. And essentially the deal had been fulfilled. The deal was they'd all get a hearing at the, you give up your blue slips, that's when the hearing happens. And then you had yesterday, Dick Durbin said he had real concerns. Chuck Schumer said that he had significant doubts. Patty Murray said she's not inclined to support the nomination. And then last night, you had Debbie Stabenow said she cannot support his nomination. Barbara Boxer, I share deep concerns. And then Chris Coons said it was pretty clear that he has some real explaining to do, and there's some concerns. And then Tammy Baldwin came out, said later that day she can't support Boggs either. And so this is basically dead in the water. But in some respects, what is most interesting about this is that we are seeing the sort of post-Obama mobilization, where we're seeing people push back against, you know, and it's limited, of course, but, this, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day.
Well, I think what's kind of fascinating and kind of go back to what we were talking about earlier, I think that the left has kind of been on defense against birtherism and against, you know, trying to defend Obama's against this kind of onslaught of being accused of being a communist tyrant dictator, you know, Maoist, and you know, spent so much time kind of defending what they, you know, their president against that, that they didn't actually have time to go, wait a second, like there's a lot of you know, he's a pretty moderate Republican in the White House. He just is. And there are, and also getting him into the White House and getting him to be a two-term president isn't an end-all be-all, that government takes participation, that, you know, a republic takes participation, that, you know, if you want something, you have to actually voice your opinion and not just kind of be passive and satisfied that Obama's in there so he has our back.
Yeah, and I, you know, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to read too much into this, but, you know, you got Harry Reid also this week coming onto the floor calling for a constitutional amendment to define speech as not a function of money. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. Obviously.
But it's like, I think it's so disingenuous when politicians say we're going to amend, like that's not going to happen. Republicans love to say that because it sounds like they're really passionate about something, that they love the Constitution and so they need to change it and this is what we're going to do. That's just not going to happen. I mean, there has to be a more substantial way of changing this. And like that particular cry, that particular ask makes me nuts, but please continue.
Well, I mean, okay. All right, granted. Although I will say that I think that there is a sort of an under the radar movement in the states to head in that direction. It may or may not happen.
And Montana has
right.
already.
No, well, no, but I mean, I think, you know, and, you know, Lessig has got a PAC that just has, you know, raised $1 million. You've got Wolfpack out there that the Young Turks mm-hmm. have started. There are other groups that are doing this. But I guess my point is that there seems to be an awareness that has been sorely missing, that at the very least, and maybe it is just the very least, that the Democrats need to rhetorically address issues that are important to their base. And, you know, I don't know that I would include net neutrality in that necessarily, because it's a much broader, more diverse coalition, but there definitely seems to be an awareness, that a growing awareness. I mean, if you look across the states at where people are running now, even particularly in the red states, you have Kay Hagan talking about I think it's, you know, expansion of Medicaid and, you know, mm-hmm. essentially Obamacare. You get Alison Grimes talking about the minimum wage. You've got in Hawaii. You've got the progressive candidate against Hanabusa, Schatz, running on expanding Social Security. You've got Begich in Alaska running on expanding Social Security. Whether or not these things are going to happen, the more that it's out there, the more that these positions are taken, particularly by candidates, the more this gets into the bloodstream of the Democratic Party. And there's a lot of things that I would like to see them take up rhetorically, even more so, because look, that's the way that it starts. I mean, it's a long project. I don't want to, you know, I'm not being, you know, what Pollyanna-ish here or Cassandra-ish or one of those. But
right, but it's getting Democrats off offense and back to defense, or not off defense and back to offense.
Indeed,
if they've ever been on offense, you know, taking the charge on this instead of just, you know, defending and kind of apologizing for, I mean, you know, that this was healthcare reform was something that was not going to be easy and it wasn't going to be perfect. But having the Democrats going, well, you know, kind of taking a more of a passive stance on that than going, no, this is fantastic. People are actually getting coverage and the Medicaid expansion is actually working, and kind of now being and also hanging around the necks of Republicans that they voted to make, by voting for the Paul Ryan budget, they voted to make Social Security basically a voucher system.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that is a big deal. These are things that you can be a Republican and be very conservative, but at the end of the day, want your Social Security check to come in the mail. You know, that was the big thing with kind of convincing people that they could be against the government, but for public transportation when this whole debate started 5 years ago, or that they can be, against the government, but they can enjoy their Social Security, or they can be against the government, but somehow think that that is not in the Constitution.
Right.
I mean, seriously.
Right. Well, you got to
actually think that.
You want the government's hands off your Medicare is basically right. What it comes down
Precisely.
To.
Precisely.
All right.
And having that disconnect and kind of capitalizing on that disconnect and Democrats need to, stop explaining it to people and start, leading.
And you know, to a certain extent, I know there was a big poll that I think came out the other day by a Democratic polling outfit that talked about how important it is to get millennials out to vote on this off-year election. I mean, there just seems to be a broader consensus that if you're going to at the very least, you know, avert disaster in the midterms, you need to play to your base and you need to activate more of these people who are inclined to come out and vote during presidential elections. And I think all of that is part of this. I mean, I think, you know, Harry Reid's call for, making money not be equivalent to speech is part of a broader conversation about the Koch brothers, which is a broader conversation about the plutocracy in this country. There is an awareness, at least from a rhetorical standpoint. I don't want to overplay the value of it in the short term or even in the midterm. But, if they win on this type of rhetoric, it becomes, at least to a certain extent, a self-fulfilling prophecy on some level. I mean, it certainly pushes in the right direction. And all this is also coming, which is stunning. But since June, there have been 11 federal rulings against state gay marriage bans since June of this year. I mean, or I should say since June of last year. Right. So we're talking over the course of less than a year. We've seen there are 32 states that prohibit it. But we still have just seen these things are dropping like flies. The latest was in Arkansas where gay marriages will be that were halted are going to resume. In Idaho, there's a stay on that decision, but also a judge struck down in a federal court their marriage equality ban. So, I mean, it's, the times are a changing. Spotty, yes.
But definitely, but rapidly changing. And also, and Americans are warming up to this whole idea. You would just the idea of the if you go back and look at the Proposition 8. I lived in California at that time. And if you look at the Proposition 8 commercials about this storm of brewing and all this stuff, it's like it's kind of laughable. Just public opinion has. And that was successful. That was a successful campaign. that it was going to, you know, turn all of our children gay. This was California that this was happening in. It was backed by money from the Mormon Church, right, which is kind of hilarious since they traditional marriage in the Mormon Church was not what you would call traditional. You'd call that more biblical, but, you know, a discussion for another time. But that was a very successful campaign based on people's fears of same-sex marriage. And now, you know, people, you know, there have been no raining down of frogs anywhere in America. We've yet to see, you know, children suddenly all turn gay. All the things that we were warned about the apocalypse has not happened. And people are starting to see that gay married couples are just as boring as regular married couples. And that opposing this is real, doesn't really have the same kind of fire, and it doesn't really have the same cachet to motivate the base as it once did. And so that to me is indicative of a win. I think that the fast food strikers also could learn a lot from this, from the success of the gay marriage campaign that started very slowly. Things like this don't happen overnight. I mean, even if you look back at like the when kids started sitting, when black students started sitting at the lunch counters, it took 4 years for integration to happen after those protests. It wasn't like the next day when the South was no longer, it became integrated. So these things take a very long time, and there are successes and you can lose a battle and still win the war, which is what we've seen in gay marriage. It's been very steady, but it's gone along with public opinion that has started to warm up to this idea. It's been positive stories in the media, which GLAAD has been flawless at, rewarding good behavior and kind of publicly shaming bad behavior as far as media perceptions and depictions of gay characters. There was a time, I mean, you look at stuff from the 70s, and if you were gay, you were basically a rapist, or, you know, some kind of pansy. Like, there was a very, like, specific role for homosexuals in media. And so that has changed dramatically through activism. This has been, you know, I think that we should definitely take note of how change happens.
Yeah, I agree with all that, although I will say that there's fundamentally something different, I think, between what is a civil rights issue and something that is, I mean, I think it's just, there's a different alignment when you're talking about money. When you're talking about things like minimum wage.
More sympathetic. Well, but I think the fast food workers, I mean, I think they have a very sympathetic case. I think that they've kind of endured the same, you know, public shaming, the poor shaming, that famously, what is his name? Is it Tillis? Who, there was a release of his statement that he made a couple of years ago that we need to divide and conquer people on public assistance.
North Carolina.
And I was like, that's exactly what the playbook has been, right? Like, we have to basically get poor people to fight amongst each other, in order to, you know, fight over the scraps, and then then, you know, we don't have to address their needs. So I think that also, if you have a really crappy job, you immediately compare it to McDonald's. If you're a loser, you work at McDonald's. I mean, there's this kind of like vernacular that we've been used to hearing and using about fast food workers that they have to combat. But I think ultimately they are very sympathetic. I mean, people who want to work and not be on public assistance, for example, people who are, you know, these are not people who are lazy. These are not people who are just asking for a handout. These are people who are working really hard.
But the issue, Tina, is not
to get above the poverty line.
The issue is not that they're sympathetic. I mean, we already know the polling is up there for raising the minimum wage. The issue ultimately to me is that there are gay plutocrats. And there are, you know, there are not minimum wage earning plutocrats. I think, you know, at the end of the day, that is a key distinction. With that said, you know, there's definitely stuff to learn from the marriage equality movement. But
labor issues have been successful. Unions have been successful in this country, you know, historically without having, you know, blue collar plutocrats.
Right.
I mean, labor has had a lot of wins, not recently, but labor has had wins in this country over the last 100 years. You know, we have yet to completely reverse all of their wins. Some of them have been sidestepped. You know, if Gingrich had his way, we would see child janitors again. But thankfully he is not in power anywhere. So yes, I agree with you. That's an interesting point. But however, that I don't think it's necessary to have a grassroots win.
From your mouth to God's ears. Now, let's just, I want to touch on this too. Yesterday we had the vote where Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC's new proposal to essentially destroy net neutrality, but still say that we have net neutrality, was voted 3-2, three Democrats versus two Republicans, to move ahead into a more formalized proposal stage. I think they'll take comments on this until mid-July. The two Republicans do not want any regulation of the internet whatsoever, so they always vote against it. But
and they want to defer to Congress, which to me is like, I want nothing to ever happen, which is the same stance that Ted Cruz has taken, that he wants Congress to do this. And it's like, okay, so you want this to never have any kind of
right. They don't
whatsoever.
Want any regulation. But the fact is that Congress has already spoken on this, and it was the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and it empowers the FCC to create these regulations under Classification 1, which the Bush administration moved the internet under, as opposed to Classification 2, which is a common carrier equivalent to things like the phone company and phone services. And what has really happened over the past, really, I guess, month, maybe month and a half since Tom Wheeler announced this new proposal is that we have seen a tremendous amount of pushback. And I think the big SOPA fight that took place a couple of years ago also has now made particularly Democratic congressmen and women far more nervous about the implications. And the community, I think about 3 million plus comments on this, the community involved in pushing back against the FCC's potential attack on net neutrality is formidable and is having political effect. The biggest change in my mind, now, tomorrow, Tom Wheeler could say we're reclassifying internet providers under classification 2 as common carriers. And this would be all over but for the inevitable litigation, which is going to take place anyways. There's always going to be litigation. But if it is up to the plaintiffs, i.e. Comcast or Verizon or whoever would sue, to change classification, that's going to inhibit their future plans in terms of, because they've got to assume that that's going to happen. The biggest change that has happened, which is stunning to me, is that back in, I think it was 2010, when Obama's new FCC head then, Jankowski, or I can't pronounce his name, Jules Jankowski, was trying to either decide whether to reclassify or to try and create a scheme under classification one, there were 74 Democrats who signed a letter to Jankowski to back away from reclassification. This year, only 20 signatures could be garnered for that same letter to Tom Wheeler, and 37 people signed a letter saying the opposite, saying classification two. And I think there was also like a half dozen to a dozen in the Senate who signed that similar letter. So we have seen the political change because they have responded both to the outcry, but also the fear of what happened after SOPA. And we know that the two other Democratic commissioners on there have expressed a big reservations. I think we could be headed to classification two. And that's a huge change. And I don't know. Maybe I'm feeling just too optimistic this week because my son is not waking up every 3 hours this week.
And I've gotten sleep. Yeah, sleep can make a person optimistic. Definitely. I think that there is a level playing field that we've always kind of assumed with the internet, right? Like we were able to access, like the dream of the internet when it first started was that it was going to be the information superhighway. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Now it's kind of like the bullshit superhighway, but that's another discussion for another time. But there was going to be this kind of utopian place where we could all go, we could all have access to everything. We would have transparency. Everything was free. There was a time when if you charged for anything on the internet, it was like it was totally taboo. Everything, you know, everybody was supposed to give everything for free, and you could just be there and take part in this utopian society. And so I think there's still that kind of feeling that if you ruin that, if you change that, if you turn it into like basically what would mirror the rest of our country, right? Where there's like the life is really good for the people who have a lot and life is kind of crappy for the rest of us. And that like, if you have much, then much is given to you. And then the rest of us kind of can only hope to someday get there. That is something antithetical to the internet, and it's against what people at the beginning imagined it to be and what it shouldn't be. And so it kind of like breeds that innate activism in people. And even if you don't understand net neutrality, because it's a horrible word, a horrible term that is antiquated in itself and kind of get it. And when you say the term net neutrality, your eyes kind of glaze over. Because it's also a complicated issue that most people who don't know how to, you know, attach a picture and email are never going to understand. But the people who do, it kind of, it's an important issue that they can easily speak up about it to lawmakers who often do not understand this stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if Wheeler actually understands what he's talking about.
I think he does.
Is what I find to be frightening. I think that he actually is not quite clear as to what net neutrality actually is and means.
Oh no, I give him far more credit. This guy was spent a long time in the industry as a lobbyist. He knows exactly what it is. And you know, here's the key. There was one key, and we'll wrap this up. But there was one key quote that he gave. And he said this during the Thursday meeting: if a network operator slowed the speed of service below that which the consumer bought, it would be commercially unreasonable and therefore prohibited. If the network operator blocked access to lawful content, it would violate our no blocking rule and therefore be doubly prohibited. Basically, what he's saying is that, like, look, you will be able to get the internet you get today. It's just that all the innovation will basically be sequestered for those massive companies who choose to pay for it and keep out any other innovation or any other people who want access. So in other words, this is as good as it gets. 30 years from now, if you are one of the poors or one of the not riches, you will have the internet service you had 30 years ago because there'll be no incentive whatsoever to raise that floor. In fact, there'll be a disincentive to raise that floor, because then you will be obligated to always provide it. So basically, it would put in amber, it would just create an anchor. This is as low as it can go. And then if you want to go any better, you got to pay money. And I will say this, there's a story out today that, or maybe this is from a day or two ago, David Cohen, the executive vice president of Comcast, said at a conference on Wednesday that within 5 years' time, the company will have a usage-based billing model rolled out across its footprint. Now, this is a slightly separate issue, but Comcast is already planning. And they're saying this stuff when they're on the verge of becoming a huge, I don't know how else you call it, monopoly. 80% of people
getting... That was part of the deal for them to become a monopoly, is that they would have like net neutrality rules for the next 5 years, right? So it was like 2018, then they could change it.
Yeah, and then they're talking about basically a tiered usage of data. And, you know, it's just... That's where they want to go. They want to be able to charge on both ends of this thing.
Right. We won't take advantage of our monopoly for 5 years. So, yeah. Exactly.
Tina Dupuy.
It's outrageous.
Syndicated columnist. Outrageous. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tina.
Thanks, Sam. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we've got a Jimmy Reefercake song, I believe, on the docket. Matt, tell me about that song.
Well, it's about Jimmy Reefercake's favorite person in the world, governor of Maine, Paul
Lepage. All right, let's hear it.
All right, hold up. It's loading right now. And here we go.
Sitting on his fat ass in the governor's mansion, he paid the hospitals but refused Medicaid expansion. Tell me, how does it make any sense? Oh, the rich getting richer off the poor folks' expense. The people of Maine had enough of it. Paul Lepage, you're a goddamn hypocrite. The Alexander Group, the sleaziest of the sleaze, paid $1 million to spew what they please. They skew all the numbers while they screw us over. LePage holding Vaseline saying bend over. Any Mainer who would vote for him has got to be insane. He'll run those tar sands oils right through the Gulf of Maine. He'll make the water dirty when it used to be clean, because he's big, fat, stupid, grumpy, ugly, and mean. The people of Maine, ah, we had enough of it. Paul LePage, you just a god. Damn, a hypocrite.
Wow.
Not very libertarian, I guess.
Not libertarian, and not, did we not hear any marijuana references?
No.
No marijuana references.
I think when Jimmy Reefercake does a song about his governor, that's when he gets really serious.
Yeah. He brings it home.
He puts
all right.
on the. But I just have a real quick question about it. I agree with everything. I don't know, where is he hypocritical though? Lepage. I don't follow that part of it. Everything else I totally get.
Well, it's also branded, because that's Jimmy's.
That's the branding. All right,
blog. All the hypocrisy.com. So.
I get.
But
that.
I get what you're saying. Lepage is sort of right out there. He's not.
Lepage is like, an absolutely terrible person sitting here trying to make life worse for most Mainers. He seems pretty overt about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like an experiment. Let's see if I can get him to vote for me again, just even though I'm being very straightforward about that. Folks, let me be straightforward. This show exists based on your support. And you can become a member today at majority.fm. And as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes a day. So, for instance, today we're going to play this. It's pretty disturbing. Well, Alex Jones sound of him at a Moms Demand Action rally. This is a group that I think came out of Sandy Hook, right?
Yes.
And then we will also play a new Chief Kessler. This is the former, I believe the former chief of a town in Pennsylvania, who was the guy who was coming on libtards, shooting off guns. He is back. And we've got a video from him. Also on the program, we will talk about this Turkey mine disaster and a policeman, or not a policeman, but a guy who sits on the police commission that oversees policemen up in Wilkesboro, New Hampshire, who seems like a really wonderful fellow. And we've also obviously got a report on the spring militia. Spring is coming, ladies and gentlemen. It has come today. There are reportedly 10 to 30 million Americans who will be headed to the nation's capital.
It's just like the bus rally. It's not getting covered.
It's not getting covered. 10 to 20 million people, 10 to 30 million people. I mean, I know that's a big gulf, but, you know, there may be a lot of people who are busy. Who are going to show up to arrest just about everybody in government. And, you know, we dare to report it.
It's pretty crazy. There's also some information about what they plan on doing after they overthrow the government.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half. Only the members can know. We're going to head into the better half. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to support the program, you can go to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on our Amazon link. If you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through there. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IM, you can IM us through the app at majorityapp.com or through AIM at Majority FM. People still have AIM? They must. Somebody. Also, give us a review. That's the sound you put when you put the knife in. Also, give us a review on iTunes. See you in the better half.